Welcome, everyone, to the Friday night public discussion group of Perfecting Horizons Institute. We are in paper 93, section 7, which is old single column, page 1021. All right, we basically finished their little overview of Melchizedek's relationship with Abraham, and how Abraham went through all of his ebbs and flows until he finally got himself as definitively as he could set in the direction that Melchizedek was encouraging him to challenge himself forward in. They'll bring up a little bit more about Abraham and and some of the the things that are said in Genesis relative to Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Joseph, etc. But they're definitely kind of moving towards closing down the story. Remember, it's only 94 years that he was actually here, so. By the time we go through all that effort with Abraham, obviously, many decades have rolled by, not to mention the decades before Abraham was on the scene. So, there, as you can see by our next section here, they're already pointing us to the efforts of the missionaries as they headed out from the neighborhood of Salem, and in short order, you'll see they'll be talking about his departure, Melchizedek's departure. So we're in kind of the closing phases, and then we go into very extensive subsequent papers about more of the details of what the missionaries were up to. But they're going to give us the little preface to it here. Let's see, is there anything else we need to say up front? Don't think so. I think we'll just get into it here. I'll make some comments about some things we were talking about at the end last time here. Once we get in a little bit, go ahead.
Section 7, Melchizedek missionaries. Melchizedek continued for some years to instruct his students and to train the Salem missionaries, who penetrated to all the surrounding tribes, especially to Egypt, Mesopotamia, and Asia Minor. And as the decades passed, these teachers journeyed farther and farther from Salem, carrying with them Machaventa's gospel of belief and faith in God.
Okay, so you can see that in obvious geographic necessity, you start close and it moves out from there. And so, you basically have in every direction you can go, already, kind of laying out, sort of the first kind of extended home bases, from Salem. You see them mentioning, so you go to the south, and to Egypt. You go to the, up over the Fertile Crescent, over to the east there in Mesopotamia, and Asia Minor, what we now call Turkey, basically. So in other words, that whole surrounding region, around Palestine is going to be an immediate sort of home base extension of the people that are going to then spread out far and wide from there. With just one other little item there, remember how at the end, you know, that very last sentence, that very last part of that last sentence in the preceding section, we were commenting a little bit on this at the end when it said about Abraham, and he did believe in Machaventa Melchizedek. And we were talking a little bit about how to think about the use of the word belief there. And to not falsely think that it was just some mere belief, mere superficial phenomenon that they were referring to. Look at what you have right there at the end of this paragraph. Machaventa's gospel of belief and faith in God. All right, so there's the classic pair separated by the word and, right? The foundational word is faith. All right, the belief is predicated on faith. Right? They don't have to spell that all out every time. You should be able to recognize in context when it's that more realityized, reality-based belief that they're referring to somewhere in the book. Remember again, the whole point was to of Machaventa's mission in terms of engaging individuals was to try to foster an awakening of a genuine faith consciousness, faith-based consciousness. It's not surprising that faith would be the foundational word there, right? And that he's trying to get them to approach belief from the top down as best he can. You know, remember we pointed out some things he's doing is kind of very simplistic, you know, in a sense of, you know, don't think of your gods as being in the plane with you, but kind of think more like a quote-unquote sky father, you know, just by, you know, getting them to think in literal terms about God being above, unwittingly they'll have a little bit more tendency to think top-down about belief, right? It's just going to be innate in that effort he made to bias their consciousness to think a little bit more in a vertical way, you know, and less in just a merely horizontal way. So, not surprisingly, there as we kind of leave a lot of the immediacies of his work behind, you know, they remind us of that. It's predicated on faith. You know, and it begins within you, in terms of how you act out into the world, with a belief that's based on that faith, and then in terms of how you mature relative to the cosmos, predicated on that faith, that's where trust comes in. So it's kind of trust and faith when you're kind of orienting yourself upward towards the cosmos and God, and belief and faith when you're orienting yourself from that faith nucleus down and out to others. That's a little predicate. What else do they say here?
The descendants of Adamson, clustered about the shores of the Lake of Van, were willing listeners to the Hittite teachers of the Salem cult. From this one-time Andite center, teachers were dispatched to the remote regions of both Europe and Asia. Salem missionaries penetrated all Europe, even to the British Isles. One group went by way of the Faroes to the Andonites of Iceland. while another traveled China,
traversed
China, and reached the Japanese of the Eastern Islands. The lives and experiences of the men and women who ventured forth from Salem, Mesopotamia, and Lake Van to enlighten the tribes of the Eastern Hemisphere present a heroic chapter in the annals of the human race.
Like we said, they're going to spend a lot of time in subsequent papers talking about that heroic chapter in the annals of the human race. And right at the end there, you can see just what I was saying from the first paragraph. It's not just Salem, but Mesopotamia and Lake Van, that area that become these sort of satellite launching points for the greater missionary missions. And including, going, so basically going over, the entire span of the Eastern Hemisphere, including going, up the British Isles, going off of Scotland, going up to the Faroe Islands, and then going over to Iceland. You might note the Andenites of Iceland. Little reminder of, we don't have any clue right now about how those Andenites way, 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 way back, starting extremely far back, hundreds of thousands of years ago, were moving across over to the New World. The idea that it was just, a few centuries into, after Christ, that you had the first people getting to Iceland. Right? It's like, no, okay, there were people there long ago. Just as there were people related to the Andite migrations out in the Pacific Islands way before, any scientists today think there was anyone out there. Okay, so it's almost anywhere you go, including North America, the history is so much older than what current science thinks. But all that, all that faded away to the point where by the time kind of more modern stuff happened, we're just oblivious to any of that. I mean, it was so long ago that it faded away that you basically have no sign that it was there. So you can think, oh, we're the first people to Iceland, in the 700s or something.
In the Jesus papers, when Jesus took Gani to the library, though, there were a lot of references.
Yeah, but it's not like we lost.
It didn't say where they all came from.
Yeah, but see, again, remember, recorded history still only starts, around 6,000 BC. And that's very, near. You don't have people, writing about what was going on in Iceland or anything like that and having that in the library at Alexandria, and that was lost or something. I mean, don't overplay what was in that Alexandrian library. I mean, stuff was lost.
Sounded
but
pretty impressive.
Yeah, I mean, it was impressive, but it's not like anyone knew about the Andites and that was written in the Alexandrian Library or anything like that. I mean, that was all just so lost. I mean, you'll see here, we're about to read, something that's going to demonstrate exactly what I'm talking about. I mean, you got to remember how difficult it was for anything to last when you didn't have written languages or, and certainly no, printing press, right, or anything like that. But despite that, they're just pointing out, it's not like they don't know that there's places to go. They knew that, you needed to go all the way over to Iceland, right? And so, but, even that was lost, and they had to rediscover that there was Iceland, It's not like just no one was there, no one wanted to go there, no one knew it was there for a long time. So all the way from Iceland, all the way over into Japan. And that, so that that fact that you know, that those Melchizedek missionaries were so extensive in their travels, you know, it's just you know, important to keep in mind right up front here. And we'll, like I said, we'll get into the details when we go into subsequent papers. You know, everyone remembers that, you know, going all the way back to Van, you know, literally, with the prince's staff, we still have a Lake Van, still have a lake named after him there in Turkey. And, you know, even at this late date, they're pointing out, even though you don't, you know, have definitive andites, you know, anymore at this late of a date, nonetheless, you still have, you know, you probably have some, you know, relatively better genetics in that area, and you definitely have some shadows, cultural shadows. So, like they're saying, you had willing listeners, you know, up there. And so it was kind of easy for it to become a satellite center. So even at that late date, it still played a significant role here. All, you know, oh so long since Adamson was there. Let's see, anything else there? Okay, no, I think that's, yeah, that's all we need there. Keep going.
But the task was so great, and the tribes were so backward, that the results were vague and indefinite. From one generation to another, the Salem Gospel found lodgment here and there. But except in Palestine, never was the idea of one God able to claim the continued allegiance of a whole tribe or race. Long before the coming of Jesus, the teachings of the early Salem missionaries had generally become generally submerged in the older and more universal superstitions and beliefs. The original Melchizedek gospel had been almost wholly absorbed in the beliefs in the Great Mother, the Son, and other ancient cults.
Does anybody know, has anybody ever read the Book of Kells?
No.
It's an art. I just wonder if there's any information in there that goes back to that time.
You know, I mean, well, you know, the thing is, it's kind of, I mean, even if we have things that are, you know, kind of here or there in some of our ancient records, it's so difficult to know what to do with those ancient records. I mean, you know, you can't take them very literally and directly, because no one until very recent times wrote with any sort of a sense of you know, scientific facts, historic fact sort of consciousness in mind. That just wasn't a part of human thinking until very recently, to think in terms of facts. It's, so, you know, they're telling stories that, you know, are trying to convey a certain lesson, you know, what we often kind of loosely say, the spirit of something or other. You know, and then on top of that, like they're saying, almost immediately, anything that, you know, definitive that was put out by some revelator or something over the ages gets blurred into all the evolutionary stuff. You know, even them mentioning the Great Mother, you know, remember that's the fact that that Cain, you know, had Eve, but not Adam, as a parent when he, you know, when he went off to the east from the second garden, you know, that quickly spawned a fixation on a mother deity sort of a notion, you know, that goes all the way on down till today, you know, through the Virgin Mary, you know, that great mother, the mother cult, and it's all just the, you know, the aggrandizement of remembering Eve, the real historical Eve. You know, so, sure, you know, the Revelators can point that out, and you go, oh, well, yeah, there's things that kind of are pointing to back that there really was an Eve. Okay, but it's not like the details of anything that you read anywhere have any validity whatsoever. It's all just stories. You know, I mean, the very fact that, like I was just saying a minute ago, that Machaventa tried to get them to think a little bit more in terms of a quote-unquote sky father, you know, a father in heaven, than some god, you know, that's very anthropomorphic and playing around in the plane with us. You know, when you lose the, you know, that little bit of proper abstraction in thinking about that, you know, but you remember to turn your head up and you go, oh, there's the orb. Okay, yeah, yeah, that's what that was about, right? It's the sun god, right? And so you know, Melchizedek getting people to look up for God just gets them to kind of end up, you know, being all the more certain about the sun being God. You know, and that's just the way, you know, our limited nature tends to be. I mean, it's why there's such hands-on fostering, you know, day in and day out for hundreds of thousands of years on a normal world. Because when people are relatively primitive, I mean, they just need to be parented every day to kind of keep them from drifting off into what comes naturally for little children of God, all sorts of confused notions.
Look, I want to say, in the next paragraph, says he not only extended the tithing system, but also instituted many improved methods of conducting the business of the school.
Right. Yeah. So, yeah, like we read last time. Yeah, I mean, again, but as they're trying to point out, and they'll see they'll mention it even further when we get a couple more sections here. I mean, you know, there was a school at Salem, you know, and they were trying to very methodically teach, but it just doesn't last very long, right? You go forward three generations, you know, and, you know, I mean, it's like, remember, even just 2,000 years ago, so you do all the fancy stuff that Jesus did during his time here, you know, and you go forward just a couple centuries from when Jesus was alive and you could go up and shake his hand or give him a hug. I mean, you go forward a couple centuries and there was basically no one on the planet that believed that Jesus was flesh and blood. You know, they all just thought that people were telling stories, you know, that they don't have anything to do with historical fact. You know, they're just stories and you're supposed to envision some mystical spirit being, you know, or something. You're not supposed to think of, no, there was this literally guy that if you poked him, he bled, and, you know, he was, you know, born of woman, and, you know. I mean, that's why they had to start celebrating the birth of Jesus, just to remind everyone, you know, remind all the Christians, quote unquote, that, no, you're supposed to be remembering an actual human type being that lived, not some mystical spirit being. I mean, so.
It was 4,000 years from the time of Melchizedek to the time of Jesus.
No. Just two.
Just two.
Yeah.
So, how do you explain the Jewish progression of the one God? Melchizedek Salem Commission.
No, I'm not saying that. I mean, we're going to read about that. We'll read about that in just a minute.
You're more or less saying that...
You'll see what I'm saying when we read. Yeah, well, you'll see what I'm saying when we start reading. I'm just kind of hinting at what we're about to read. But the point is just, you know, keep in mind that even if they go forward with one God, it's not going to stay true to a universal father idea. They'll be talking about one God, but it's going to be the one ghost cult God. The one God that everyone worships today is not the real universal father. It's a monotheistic ghost cult God. You know, it's a God who's a material technique. It's a ghost cult. It's a God of the plane. It's not a top-down God. It's a bottom-up God. Just monotheism is not enough. I mean, sun worship with nothing else is monotheism. Okay? It's an improvement to be worshiping just the sun and not the sun and the moon and Venus and, you know, and what have you. Okay? You're moving slowly in the direction of getting to the universal father. But, you know, you have to keep in mind how relative all this is. Okay, anyway, like they say at the beginning of that paragraph, but the task was so great and the tribes were so backward that the results were vague and indefinite. Okay? That's just the way it is. And that's why it was so important that, quote-unquote, coincidentally, the spiritual quickening happened in the 6th century B.C. Even after 300,000 years of an Integrus prince's staff working with humanity, you know, they could barely get anywhere. I mean, how far is Machaventa going to get in 94 years, right? How lasting is it going to be? 300,000 years, you know, and in just the span of a few thousand years after the rebellion, they'd lost everything. 300,000 years just lost in a relative blink of an eye. So 94 years work, okay, how long is that going to last? Not very long, okay, in any sort of definitive fashion. What else do they say here? This last little bit.
You who today enjoy the advantages of the art of printing little understand how difficult it was to perpetuate truth during these earlier times, how easy it was to lose sight of a new doctrine from one generation to another. There was always a tendency for the new doctrine to become absorbed into the older body of religious teaching and magical practice. A new revelation is always contaminated by the older evolutionary beliefs.
Okay, so there's one of the things I was just hinting at. We have to recognize that one of the reasons why the fifth epical revelation, was given to us in a way that it ended up being a book in my lap. Because this is the first effort. You know, after 500,000 years, to definitively challenge this natural evolutionary tendency for it to just wash back, you know, into the evolutionary mix. Jesus comes, very dramatic event, 2,000 years ago, and it basically just all washed back into the evolutionary religion. And he just became an atonement, right? He just a sin sacrifice and atonement thing. Same old, same old. Everyone just focused on him, you know, materially. No one thinks about spiritually. It's so difficult. And basically he knew that's exactly what would happen. For no other reason, he made sure he didn't leave any writings. Right? He could have left some writings. They would have been held pretty sacredly. Most likely, they would have endured. People would have killed and died for them, you know, over the centuries. But he didn't.
He was advised by the Union of Days not to.
Yeah, I mean, and one of the reasons that you can recognize why he wouldn't do that is just because of how he was coming as a bestowal son in such a non sequitur fashion. Right? I mean, you know, skipping over the magisterial son and all that, and
You know, so it's just, you know, in doing that as a dispensational revelation. But now doing this as an emergency instead of a dispensational, you know, it's a little different. You're not trying to get a hold of everyone with this revelation. You know, it has a very limited target audience. For those who, you know, the handful of people on the planet that have finally become fundamentally unsatisfied with the evolutionary religious notions, right? They just aren't satiating them anymore, and they want to challenge themselves to really engage reality and not try to just fulfill our wishful thinking with some clever scheme that we dream up about God's doing this, that, and the other thing. You know, all just for our benefit. And, you know, so, and it can, because it's in book form, and because it was done, you know, very, very precisely in book form, right, it's all geared to a very different end, to not just be something that reminds you that there's one God or something. Okay, it's trying to give you a sentence where it's important that you know the difference whether it says belief and faith or it says faith and belief. That's the kind of thing here. I mean, you know, just hundreds of thousands of things like that, you know, in the book.
Somewhere in the book it says faith is intelligent, and it also says if you even have a wishful faith.
Right. I mean, and again, the book reminds you that nothing in this book is needed. Right? You don't need this for your salvation. You don't need it really for any reason at all. I mean, it's you have what you need, even without your thought adjuster and without the Spirit of Truth. You have your encirclement in the Holy Spirit, and you have a personality from the Father. You can have a faith nucleus. Okay. Just like Melchizedek said, just like Jesus tried to say. I mean, it's all just predicated on that realityizing in terms of your individual self. You know, your salvation isn't dependent upon you sorting out, you know, the Paleolithic, you know, or sorting out, you know, the Archaeozoic, right, or any of that stuff, or exactly. You know, what's the energy nature of the nucleus of an atom? Or, right? I mean, but you've got all of that in here. You know, it's a very different effort for someone who wants a logical, reality-based worldview that they can take a hold of because they're ready to let go of everything they've been holding on to all their lives. Right? The latest, you know, version of the Great Mother is just not doing it for them. The latest anthropomorphic ghost cult god is just not doing it for them. You know? And atonement, you know, just seems primitive. Why do I have to do laps in someone's blood? What's the point of that? Right? I mean, it's not making sense anymore to some people. Now, it's completely fine for most, and that's just fine. You don't need to not believe that. I mean, God loves you absolutely. God doesn't love you because of what you believe. God gives you an adjuster regardless of what you believe. You don't have to believe in God at all, and you still get an adjuster. You still have a soul. You'll still wake up in the next world. All right? That's the glory of what Jesus left behind, what Michael left behind 2,000 years ago. You know, that hopeless atheist that, you know, down the street gets into reality 101 class on the first mansion world just like you do. Okay? It's just so important to, when they say something like, "You who today enjoy the advantages of the art of printing, little understand." I mean, that just between the lines is reminding you that, wait a minute, I've got the art of printing revelation, the first one in human history, in my lap. I should think about that a little bit. Like they're saying, religious teaching and magical practice, just one little side note there. Because we just spent a bunch of time talking about it when we were talking about prayer, just remind yourself how difficult it is for humans to not think of prayer as just an alternative word for magic. Right? I don't believe in magic, I believe in prayer. And you think the difference is what? In name only? Genuine prayer is, like we talked about in paper 91, is more unexplored territory in general. Okay, so, yep.
Question about the Salem missionaries.
Yep.
That they went, and there's no number of it, but they went all the way to Japan and to Iceland.
Yep.
So my question, 3,000 years later, more than 3,000 years later,
mm-hmm.
Marco Polo, which took this mm-hmm. journey, China, it took so much, such a huge expedition, and so many things, like there were no letters. I mean, what happened to them? Did they come back? Did they have to learn the languages? Did they, all these
places? Again, like I said, the papers after this, you're going to go in, there's a whole paper on the Melchizedek missionaries in the Orient. We'll talk all about what they did, how that all played out, how that engaged the culture there. Yeah, so that's all coming up. Like I said, this is just a little teaser about that. All right. Ready to go on here? Okay.
Section 8, Departure of Melchizedek. It was shortly after the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah that Machavanta decided to end his emergency bestowal on Urantia. Melchizedek's decision to terminate his sojourn in the flesh was influenced by numerous conditions, chief of which was the growing tendency of the surrounding tribes and even of his immediate associates to regard him as a demigod, to look upon him as a supernatural being, which indeed he was, but they were beginning to reverence him unduly and with a highly superstitious fear. In addition to these reasons, Melchizedek wanted to leave the scene of his earthly activities a sufficient length of time before Abraham's death to ensure that the truth of the one and only God would become strongly established in the minds of his followers. Accordingly, Machavanta retired one night to his tent at Salem. Having said good night to his human companions, and when they went to call him in the morning, he was not there, for his fellows had taken him.
So, didn't even say goodbye, just wasn't in the tent the next morning. Just as unceremoniously as he arrived, he left. So we have this one paragraph section here. Just a little aside, I mentioned it before, but, for those historians that have convinced themselves that there probably never was a Sodom and Gomorrah, that those, like I was saying a minute ago, they know how much storytelling back in those days was just that, storytelling. I mean, it wasn't meant to be historical accounts. Cities don't have to be real in the stories, but the revelators love to give you little things, between the lines. No, there really was little cities there called Sodom and Gomorrah. They weren't destroyed by Yahweh with some magical act. You know, they were. Remember, we've read that before. They fell by natural destruction, most likely. I mean, a massive earthquake here in a very active seismic region right there. So just like it plays out in Genesis, you know, even though you don't have them talking about Melchizedek and then him not being around anymore, as you read about, you know, the whole aggrandized story about Sodom and Gomorrah in Genesis, the next thing you have is what we're about to read about what Abraham does after Melchizedek's leave. So they're just saying, yeah, so just kind of overlay on the Genesis, and you know, they kind remember that as they're rewriting those stories during the exile, they have the basic bullet points of the historical record in front of them that they're reworking. You know, and so you shouldn't be surprised if there's things in the Genesis story, you know, roughly follow the sequence of real events. Okay. You know, it's just you don't have any sign that Melchizedek, you know, in that sequence of events. Okay, so there's that, and then the key thing that they're bringing out. You know, okay, there was numerous conditions, you know, that influenced his, you know, decision to leave, they said, but chief was the growing tendency of the surrounding tribes and even of his immediate associates to regard him as a demigod, to look upon him as a supernatural being. They're starting to get overawed. So they were beginning to reverence him unduly. Right? They're getting overawed. And with a highly superstitious fear, you know, the more overawed they get, the less his presence is actually going to foster further kind of upward movement in their minds. It's going to actually drive them more kind of back down to the more primitive fear level. You know, that's the overawed, you know, phenomenon. The exact same thing, you know, was happening with Jesus. It was getting just becoming impossible, and people were just so completely overawed by him that he knew, okay, it's time to let this kind of, you know, wrap up and, you know, move on, because it's starting to become net negative for me to be here. I mean, that's just how primitive we are. And you have, you know, you don't have to have Michael of Nebadon incarnate as Jesus and having him do fancy things and whatnot. It can be more straightforward, like Machaventa, but it's just, we just can't keep ourselves composed and grounded. It's just too much for us. So he's got to, he knows he's got to leave. It's just, he stays much longer. It's a definitive net negative to be there.
So why is that not a problem with the planetary prince?
The handy thing about the prince and his staff is, you know, the staff is there, and if it was just the staff, there would be this tendency, just like there was with Adam and Eve. You know, they were wanting to think of them as demigods and start worshiping them. You know, the exact same thing would happen over all those hundreds of thousands of years with a prince's staff on every world. But the prince's staff, you know, openly talk about, there's a being here with us who's greater than us that you can't see. And so it works very well. You know, don't worship us. You know, worship this unseeable, downstepped expression of the unseeable Father on high. You know, and so it gets them to think beyond the, you know, what they can see immediately. You know, and normally you've got a prince still there when you have an Adam and Eve, and so they, you know, they don't fixate on Adam and Eve either.
Well, any fixation, yeah, in the world is going to be a mistake. They have to learn to have vision and envision the Spirit, mm-hmm, because without envisioning it first, you'll never find it.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
So,
yeah.
But if they still have conflict in their mind, they can become overwhelmed.
Yeah, yeah, and it's just, I mean, a similar thing, you know, it's like the Revelators point out with, you know, to tell us we have an adjuster, you know, just knowing it's there kind of is too much for some people. They just kind of become overawed by the majesty of the thought, and it's just, it's difficult to process and maintain their composure, you know, let alone if you get a little bit too close too soon, you know, you'll be way overawed. It can be just be very difficult for you to maintain your psychological stability, because it's such a definitive phenomenon. I mean, in a full closeness sense, it's a giant bug zapper, and it'll just fry your mind, okay? Because it's as much of a, you know, as a pure energy as it is pure spirit. I mean, all these things have this similarity. When humans are as limited as we are, it's difficult. I mean, think about if you really get a profound thought, how you can't maintain emotional composure. Right, if you're trying to talk at the same time, your voice will start to crack or something. I mean, it's just, that's the way we are. I mean, if I'm talking to you and I start to really reflect on some deeply profound thing, it hits me really solidly. I can't maintain the composure of my voice. Right? I mean, we're kind of fragile. Right? It's difficult for us. Yeah. Oh yeah. I mean, you can.
Turn you can, your thinking over to the Holy Spirit. The Holy Spirit will think all your thinking for you. But people don't do that. They think they have to do all their thinking. But when you turn it over to the Spirit, it has the capacity to show you what you most need to know.
Okay. But yeah, like you're saying, but the problem is we can't maintain that objectivity. It just gets too close and too overwhelming. So here's Melchizedek 4,000 years ago. Yeah, struggling with the exact same issue. It's like, okay, it's time to move on.
Chris, yep. Do you know if there are any demigod or supernatural beings today in this planet today, or how many there are?
We don't have, you know, in kind of that sort of literal sense of a demigod. I mean, it's not like there's a corporeal being on the planet right now. That's something besides just a mortal being. You've got this corporeal being Machaventa with a literal spirit being Melchizedek type being, you know, enmeshed in his energy system. You don't have anyone like that today. You've got all kinds of celestials on the planet. Lots and lots and lots of, you know, uncountable number of celestials on the planet. Okay, but, you know, none of them are incarnated, you know, or none of them are manifesting in physical form even. Except occasionally a secondary midware for a little while might manifest, you know, visibly. But you know, that's sort of, you know, to have this person that you can come up and shake hands with that you know in some way came down from heaven so that you can kind of think of they're sort of half man, half God, quote unquote. You know, they're a demigod. You know, we don't have anyone like that.
How do you know?
From the Urantia book. Jesus was the last time we had someone that was, you know, in the flesh, and more than just the flesh. Doesn't mean there's not lots of people that believe that there are those that are more than that. I mean, of course, there's everyone has always believed that there were fancy humans of different types. Anyway, let's see what else we have there. The little technical detail. He wanted to leave the scene of his earthly activities a sufficient length of time before Abraham's death, so that he could basically hand it off to Abraham, hand it off to kind of the main evolutionary stream, and have it sort of stabilize and be sort of an in the hands of Abraham alone initiated phenomenon. So he's being very practical about this too. And then he left, like they said. So, now they want to talk to us about this question. It's like, well, okay, so suddenly, after all of the rigmarole that Abraham went through to finally give up all his military ambitions and what have you, you know, and identify so strongly with Melchizedek, he's gone. You know, how does Abraham handle this now? One can guess he's probably going to be a little bit shaky, right, for him to handle it on his own, which is another reason, see, why he wanted to give Abraham a bunch of time. So he could, you know, Abraham would kind of oscillate about a little bit, and he'd settle down, you know, into some sort of stable state for a little while before he died. Right?
They don't explain what happened to Melchizedek's body.
Right. I see all that. They just, you know, in the same way that they don't give us any details about, you know, the building of his body and, you know, how you incarnate into that, how you de-incarnate from it. And, you know, once they, you know, get him separated, however, whatever process that involves, right? And, you know, I don't know if they just have, you know, some of the celestials on the planet just disassemble the body, or they probably don't throw it in a trench, you know. But who knows what they did with it?
His fellows had taken him.
Yeah, remember, you know, they needed to disassemble, you know, Jesus's body too, you know, so that wasn't left as a relic.
But he was ascended, right? I mean, Jesus was ascended.
Well, but not his material body was just disintegrated. I mean, you know, that's the whole bit about his Maranch, you know, his he transitioned to a Maranch of body in nature. And the material body was just, you know, unraveled.
They have a lot of experience
behind it. Yeah, all of this very fancy physics, you know, these people know how to do it.
Section 9, after Melchizedek's departure. It was a great trial for Abraham when Melchizedek so suddenly disappeared. Although he had fully warned his followers that he must sometime go as he had come, they were not reconciled to the loss of their wonderful leader. The great organization built up at Salem nearly disappeared, though the traditions of these days were what Moses built upon when he led the Hebrew slaves out of Egypt.
Okay, that nearly disappeared. Okay, not instantaneously. Don't, you know, you'll see that as we continue to read here. But they're just right up front reminding of what we were talking about so much just a little bit ago. You know, all that stuff about building schools and having a fancy temple and everything there, it all just, you know, evaporates, you know, in a relatively short span of time. Because it just, you know, it's a very artificial phenomenon. It's being held together by this very artificial phenomenon of Machaventa being there. You take him away, and it just all melts back to what it was basically before, with just a slight little biasing diffused into the system. Right? In the same way that you can keep things going together as a missionary in Africa while you're there, but as soon as you leave, it just tends to melt back into what it was before. Right? But as they're pointing out, there was enough, especially because you had kind of that behind-the-scenes parallel stream of the Kenites, remember? You know, they mentioned Moses there. And it wasn't all dependent upon Abraham and how quickly, you know, his descendants kind of lost track of it. The Kenites, you know, unrecorded in the Old Testament, were keeping it alive much more definitively. I mean, so much so, even up to Jesus' time, that you can get the things written in the book of Hebrews that you do. All right? I mean, that's how, you know, how much they were keeping, recognition of Melchizedek alive, in a parallel stream to the main historical record. Someone still completely remembered. You know, one of those authors of the book of Hebrews remembered that he had no father and no mother, right? And could that could appear. That wasn't in the Jewish records that, and they threw that out. I mean, it just wasn't in there at all. They just had a few little snippets about Melchizedek, in those Jewish histories that they were making the Old Testament from. But a parallel thing, right, was keeping it alive in the Near East there. So, like we said many times, Moses is drawing heavily upon, kind of a refocused Melchizedek gospel, if you will, from that parallel stream. But just like we suspected, Abraham doesn't handle it well to begin with. You got some?
Second sentences. Although he had fully warned his followers, he must sometimes go as he had come.
Yeah.
So, why would they consider Abraham such a great prophet and not even mention Melchizedek? His followers.
Yeah, you'll see here in a minute. They explain that how it was that, but one of the things is kind of in what we read in the preceding little one paragraph section there. He was so reverenced, that it was deemed blasphemous or sacrilegious to talk or think or record anything about him, so that's one of the reasons why he fades so quickly from history. That over reverencing thing had a lot of impacts like that throughout human history. You were so afraid to even think about that, you got your wish. A generation later, no one was thinking about it because you didn't tell your children about it because you thought it was too sacred to even talk about. So
it's an interesting effect. If you happen to be Melchizedek, you want to be able to do some work for your guy who's coming later, Michael.
Yep.
And you want to disappear and have it all traced because the whole thing's about keeping the story alive. It's they're setting up the best case scenario for a learning experience.
And they're definitely doing that, and again, because it's not a dispensational revelation that Machavent is doing, I'm sure he had very tight constraints on just how much he could play with things, and have it not be in rebellion himself, right? There's this great respect for the evolutionary process. Like I was just saying a little bit ago, even with a dispensational revelation like what Jesus was doing, great respect, not leaving a written record so that, perforce it's going to kind of just melt into the evolutionary process. Again, that's one of the things that's so exceptional about the fifth epical revelation, that even though most people are going to ignore it, some that engage it will do just like they said there. A new revelation is always contaminated by the older evolutionary beliefs. They'll just take what they get in the book and they'll just, kind of make, a fancier flavor of Christianity or something. The fact, that there that you can have some a parallel stream set up that is definitively can maintain its separation from being washed into all of the, the lesser beliefs and thoughts. That's an interesting new tack. Not even Machavent was doing that with the Kenites. He was just giving it to them by word of mouth. He didn't give them documents or anything like that. So it's like the phone game. As they pass it down through the generations, it gets modified. But just think about how interesting it is that they were given permission to at least set up a small group of people on the planet that can have an ongoing separation from the evolutionary stream, and that apparently was okay to do. Just kind of interesting to think about those side issues about the book itself here. Okay, let's keep going here.
The loss of Melchizedek produced a sadness in the heart of Abraham that he never fully overcame. Hebron he had abandoned when he gave up the ambition of building a material kingdom, and now, upon the loss of his associate in the building of the spiritual kingdom, he departed from Salem, going south to live near his interests at Gerar.
Remember, Hebron is a little ways south of Jerusalem. To go to Gerar, in other words, to go down to the Negev, right, you're going even further south. But he had, remember, he was wealthy and had interests down there as well. The important thing is just how they worded that first sentence. The loss of Melchizedek produced a sadness in the heart, right, of Abraham that he never fully overcame. Yeah, remember, nowhere in the Urantia book are they using the word heart like we do. All right? That doesn't mean feelings. All right? That he just couldn't get over how sad he felt. It impacted the upper domain in the hourglass analogy of his mindal self. Right, the genuine inner domain was disrupted by that in a way that all the king's horses and all the king's men could never put back together again. Right, he could never fully regain his equilibrium up there. Hence, his stable relationship to the cosmos. So if it gets a little bit choppy and disrupted up there, there's going to be even more tendency for material gravity to drag your mind down and have you just kind of be thinking with the pack again. Right? Because the only way that spirit gravity can kind of keep your mind up is if there's stability in that upper domain. If you disrupt it some, there really isn't much that spirit gravity can get a hold of. I mean, spirit gravity is unity gravity. If it really, that upper mind has a lessened relationship to unity, right? See, there's less spiritual gravity. So in other words, you're just going to naturally drift down from material gravity in your mind and kind of just fall into what's going on around you in the external world. These people are kind of thinking about God like this, and you just kind of get sucked into it. And you'll see they mentioned that's what happens.
Probably a wise provision, because at least in your nature there's stability. If you can't have stability,
right. The reason we have such a relationship to material gravity is so that we may be minimal, but at least we're relatively stable. Right. There's no hope of gently lifting us up if there's no stable foundation. We have to have some kind of a stable foundation. So it's minimal. So what? At least it's stable. Those that are kind of just putzing along on the planet is a very rudimentary, primitive religious consciousness, what we might call kind of a fundamentalist sort of a consciousness. If they don't have some intense ideological notion where they're kind of keeping it churning from the top down in their mind, if they kind of just let it be, that's much better than someone who's kind of going off into nihilism, or whatnot. I mean, if you have to pick between those around you that are drifting towards nihilism and those who are kind of stuck in a very simplistic ghost cult religion, okay, if those are the only two choices, okay, it's the ghost cult religious group that you want to go with, not with the nihilists, right? Lucifer's not a positive future for the world.
What about the influence of the adjutants of wisdom and the adjutants of worship.
Mm-hmm.
Aren't they motivators in spite of everything to kind of centralize you on a higher, I don't know what to say,
mm-hmm.
concept?
Yeah, they're
of hidden reality.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, the sixth and seventh adjutants.
I mean, it's not quite as long.
The adjutants of worship and wisdom are definitely trying to function in that. And it's really only the seventh that's kind of what you're saying. I mean, the sixth, I mean, no one has any problem with the sixth adjutant functioning in them. Everyone has zeal in abundance. I mean, there's endless ideologies now because of the sixth adjutant, like we've talked about so much, you know, and going through the evolution of religion. Everyone is turning everything into a quasi-religious phenomenon because of the functioning of the sixth adjutant. But there's very little seventh adjutant beginning to put a governor on that, putting a bridle on the sixth adjutant, pulling back on the reins a little bit so you aren't quite so zealous, trying to get you more symmetric in your use of the other adjutants. And that's the reason for that is twofold. One, limited genetics means the seventh adjutant has a pretty minimal engagement to us. Remember, the whole point of Adam and Eve coming is to uplift our genetics so that the seventh adjutant can engage us more. So in general, we don't have, we're working with a very limited philosophic impulse from the seventh adjutant. We've got the religious impulse from the sixth, okay, but we don't have it put in a stabilizing framework by the seventh. And then the other thing is...
Doesn't that make you more intuitively responsive in spite of yourself?
I mean, yeah, I was just going to get to that. You know, the other thing about the seventh adjutant is it's a gateway to your encirclement of the Holy Spirit. So it's your gateway to the three cosmic intuitions. It's a gateway to your insight. Your common sense, for instance, you know, basically with the first cosmic intuition. But like I said, besides the genetic limitation, there's a growing ideological tendency to use your free will to short circuit that seventh adjutant Holy Spirit insight. Many people have convinced, very intelligent people have convinced themselves that there is no reality to insight. There is no reality to common sense. That's delusion. And they actively suppress it. You can read some of the best minds writing a scientific article now. And they're saying, okay, well, we've got three different theories about this issue. How do we decide which is the better theory? And the person will say, well, we know that common sense or any sense of logic is delusional. So if you just step back and look at the three theories, the one that strikes you as the most absurd has got to be the correct one. Because your common sense is a delusional thing. See, it's actually biasing you away from what's correct instead of towards what's correct. See, they literally they're willing themselves to use it 180 degrees turned around. Okay? And that willing things 180 degrees, that's what's created the emergency. That's why this book is in my lap. If everyone was just simple-minded, there wouldn't be a fifth epical revelation. Right, we would just be plodding along stably, but we've made our civilization unstable by this willful rotation and rejection of our grounding in reality through the ministry of the Holy Spirit. That began in earnest amongst intellectuals in the middle of the 19th century. That movement, that ism, is called positivism. You know, and it's a taking name. It's, yes, technically it's negativism and not positivism. But it's called positivism. And everyone goes, ooh, I want positive. You know, and what it is, it's rejecting the belief that there's any reality to objective consciousness, to insight. Right? And so by the middle of the 20th century, after 100 years of that kind of percolating in academia, and it just basically completely corrupted the philosophic integrity. I mean, it's why the book is here. Everything is collapsing because we're remember, there's none so blind as those who will not see. Okay? So you have the limited genetics, so there's some people that can't see. Okay, well, that's not an emergency. But when you will not see, that's an emergency. Okay? When you're willfully blinding yourself to anything that could stabilize civilization, it means it's all going to collapse. We talk about that all the time. That's that issue. So for many people, it's not just the spirit of truth and the thought adjuster that are sitting there twiddling their thumbs. Right? It's the seventh adjutant and their encirclement and the Holy Spirit, their personality itself, that's sitting there twiddling its thumbs, waiting for something besides a fancy animal. Okay, yep.
With the advent of Jesus. Isn't the spirit of truth, the spirit of worship a lot more effective?
The sixth adjutant it became much more active in the middle of the 20th century. The dawning of the sixth adjutant in the collective. When there was this, the leading edge of civilization had this new energy in it. Okay, but again, you got to remember, Andon and Fonta only had six and not seven adjutants for 1 year. Having just six and not seven is very unstable. There are no stable beings in the universe that have just six because it's innately an unstable mind. And so, having this, increased animation of your mind, energization of your mind with the sixth adjutant. Initially, remember, it's not the spirit of worship as much as it's the energy of zeal. It starts bottom up. Everyone is making everything into a complete lifestyle solution. Like we talked about, the sixth adjutant makes every TV commercial. Somewhere in the TV commercial, they'll tell you in so many words that it's a complete lifestyle solution, what they're selling. That's the sixth adjutant that wants to make that an ism. This is all you need. It's not just a treadmill. It comes with a CD and blah, blah, blah. It'll change your entire life.
If you act now.
Right. Everything, is being energized like that. Not to belabor this, but I just remind everyone, for those when the fifth adjutant dawned in the collective, and you had the big social reform movements that awakened in the middle of the 19th century, the social impulse, the fifth adjutant, that started a whole movement that was that led into the 20th century, and the old guard, that found themselves in the dawning of the middle of the 20th century that had sort of fully embraced that social reform, all those social reform movements, and felt like that we were on the verge of a great societal transformation and reformation. Suddenly, everything started to go off in aggressive tangents in every direction. And if you listen to those guys back then talking about it, it's like, wait a minute, what's going on? People, what are you doing? You're going off. We were all kind of all coming together, and we were all going to step forward into the future as one great enlightened social group. And then all of you turned into these little island universes of zeal, and you went flying off in every direction. What's going on? See, and that's because the sixth adjutant dawned in the collective. It put that energy in there that needs a bridle And we're waiting for the seventh adjutant to don the collective, for the bridle to come, right? I mean, we've become a herd of cats because of that. You know, and you know, it's tearing society apart. I mean, think about, talk to anyone who tries to get some sort of progressive group going and maintained for more than 5 minutes. You know, they'll tell you it's impossible. In a very short order, all these people are flying off in all sorts of tangents in every which direction. And you can't keep them between the lines and moving forward methodically, you know, with that group consciousness of the fifth adjutant, right? That associative social consciousness of the fifth adjutant. Everyone gets too amped up as an individual and they fly off on tangents. Right. Yeah. You know, and in short order, instead of whatever goal the group was formed for, the only thing they can think of that they need to focus on is conflict resolution. That's what happens to everything, because everyone is so animated by the sixth adjutant now. Yeah.
So what I'm seeing is that when the mind gets to the point where it can embrace the seventh, which is the gateway to atonement, is to turn and face your highest aspiration of God and commit to it.
Yeah, and I'll just point out, I mean, again, like I said, most of the planet does not need this book. What they need is the basic gospel that Jesus gave 2,000 years ago. Right? This is, you know, this is way beyond what they need. I mean, like we've talked about, a lot of people don't even have what Machiavelli was trying to get. They don't even have that faith nucleus that Jesus was trying to work with. Right. I mean, that's what most of the world needs, you know, and, you know, getting into all the details of straightening out the historical Melchizedek and stuff like that. Okay, that's not what they need. All right, let's get back to the, you got one more thing?
You said the reason this book came was mm-hmm. because of too much positivity.
No. No.
Okay, that's okay.
Yeah. It came because there's a philosophic, you know, the book is here because there's a philosophic emergency. The spiritual emergency that Machiavelli and Jesus were dealing with has been dealt with. Jesus did not fail, okay? There's not a spiritual emergency anymore. Everyone gets a thought adjuster by grace now. Right? The spiritual emergency is past, but there's a philosophic emergency now that will break down civilization. Doesn't impact your, you know, you getting to the next life, but civilization will collapse. That, you know, and that's what this book is addressing. Okay, let's keep going here.
Abraham became fearful and timid immediately after the disappearance of Melchizedek. He withheld his identity upon arrival at Gerar, so that Abimelech appropriated his wife. Shortly after his marriage to Sarah, Abraham one night had overheard a plot to murder him in order to get his brilliant wife. This dread became a terror to the otherwise brave and daring leader. All his life he feared that someone would kill him secretly in order to get Sarah. And this explains why, on three separate occasions, this brave man exhibited real cowardice.
Okay, so notice most of that paragraph is a parenthetical, okay? Right, it's a little, it's mostly an aside. It's like, well, what about those stories in the Bible? You know, and they're saying, okay, those, you know, there is some validity to some of that, okay? He had an Achilles heel here, you know, and especially in the absence of Melchizedek, he was overcome by, you know, the fear in this regard. So, you know, when you're reading that whole rigmarole with Abimelech, they're saying, okay, no, there's actually historical validity to, you know, to the basic story there. You know, and like I mentioned, three separate occasions, you know. So not just that occasion, but, you know, a couple other times in Genesis, you've got this whole foolishness with his fear about him stealing his wife. And, you know, and remember the way that always, you know, the way they played that, he, Abraham and Sarah played that, is, you know, they actually, Sarah was his half-sister. Right, same father, different mother. And so, you know, they would just say, he's my brother, she's my sister. Okay, you know, and they weren't lying. yeah, and skip the part that they were married. Remember, you know, there was a lot of tradition of marrying very close, you know, to keep genetics sound. You know, that's coming down from the Nadites and the Adamites. So those traditions are still in play, you know, in some of the better families, if you will, you know, of the day. All right. I guess that's about all we had there, right? Yeah. I mean, so that's just that little aside to comment on those Bible stories. All right.
I like that they describe Sarah not as beautiful or gorgeous, but as brilliant.
Brilliant, yeah. Again, genetics, right? There's some quality genetics here, right? Yeah, there's a lot more than just a pretty face. She's very, very intriguing because of her quality of mind and, you know, the sophistication that you of a relationship that you could have with her. I mean, it was very exciting and engaging.
But Abraham was not long to be deterred in his mission as the successor of Melchizedek. Soon he made converts among the Philistines and of Abimelech's people, made a treaty with them, and in turn became contaminated with many of their superstitions, particularly with their practice of sacrificing firstborn sons. Thus did Abraham again become a great leader in Palestine. He was held in reverence by all groups and honored by all kings. He was the spiritual leader of all the surrounding tribes, and his influence continued for some time after his death. During the closing years of his life, he once more returned to Hebron, the scene of his earlier activities and the place where he had worked in association with Melchizedek. Abraham's last act was to send trusty servants to the city of his brother, Nahor, on the border of Mesopotamia, to secure a woman of his own people as a wife for his son Isaac. It had long been the custom of Abraham's people to marry their cousins, and Abraham died confident in that faith in God which he had learned from Melchizedek in the vanished schools of Salem.
Okay, you remember how Nahor stayed behind up there at the top, basically, of the Fertile Crescent up by Turkey. And so, in other words, yep, that actually was part of the story. That's not made up in the Bible. You know, that's basically as it's recounted there in Genesis. That's how Isaac got his wife. And then it was one of the last things that Abraham was seeing to before he died. But notice, like we were saying in the earlier part of that paragraph, these are such great big huge paragraphs here. In the earlier part of that paragraph, Abraham is, you know, is already, I mean, forget about going to Isaac and Jacob, etc., but just Abraham himself is already quickly, in the absence of Melchizedek, blending in with the natives, as it were. It should be obvious to everyone why they say, particularly with their practice of sacrificing firstborn sons. Oh, that's where the sacrificing Isaac story comes from. And they're just reminding you between the lines of why that gets in there, right? You know, it's just because they're, you know, he cannot maintain that more abstract concept of God, you know, and its separation from all the ghost cult rituals and notions like sacrifice, you know, by himself. Once Melchizedek is gone, he just starts slipping right back into it all. Yep.
Yes, it was sacrificing Ishmael, his firstborn, and And there's no mention of Ishvara.
We'll get there. I mean, they don't give, as you can tell by here, what they're saying here, it's not like they're going to go through all the details of the Genesis story. That's not the point of what they're doing here. The only reason for giving you, disclosing facts like they do in the book is in their effort to reveal truth, if you have too disrupted a factual base that you're reflecting upon, there's no way to get the truth that's flowing through what they're talking about. And again, remember, the Urantia book is just half of what you need in terms of that sort of foundation for your reflection. If you use a spherical analogy, there's two hemispheres. At the upper hemisphere of the full philosophic perspective is the metaphysics, which comes from divine revelation. You can't generate the upper hemisphere from the bottom up. Now, as humans, that has to be given to you, a true metaphysics, a true upper hemisphere to your sphere of philosophy in which to properly think within. The lower hemisphere, the human philosophy, the up from the humus, the lower hemisphere, that you have to add to what's in the book. So you have to take the best of what humans have produced, separate the wheat from the chaff, okay, which is going to take a lot of effort because there's a lot of chaff in the 2,600 years of human philosophic, reflective thinking. But if you can use your objective insight to sort through that and separate the wheat from the chaff, get the true part of that human philosophy. So you have the lower hemisphere. And the other half of the picture from what you have here, put the two together, synthesize them, and then in that holistic space, you can begin to seek for the revelation of truth that you can't read.
Right? I want to say something.
Yep.
And the Urantia book saved my life.
Mm-hmm.
And, it gave me insight that survival isn't really capable of doing. And the way I describe it is that if you read the whole Urantia book, it gives you a holographic picture of reality. So I don't understand. I don't know if I'm right or not. But I don't understand what you mean by half is missing. You're trying to arrive at.
It's
a skeletal draft.
I mean, it's one way of thinking about, let's say you're interested in fundamental physics, okay? You don't have the entire physics textbook in the Urantia book, right? You have the better set of initial assumptions.
But that's not necessarily the point of the book.
Yeah, it is. The point of the book is...
The point of the book is to try to get the world on the same page.
Yeah.
According to basic truth.
Right, but again, like I said, it's not trying to get the whole world. I mean, it's trying to get those who are looking for that big picture. It's trying to get them on the same page. It's trying to get them grounded in reality. And remember how radically different the Urantia book is from what Jesus was trying to do. Right? Jesus, when they wanted him to comment about better ideas of God, he said, no, forget about the ideas of God. Your mission as an apostle of me is you just want to foster the addition of ideals, the ideal of God, the ideal of his infinite and eternal nature. Let the ideas of God just be whatever they are right now. Right? Jesus was trying to just add the spiritual, the ideals, to the material conceptions, the ideas, and letting those material ideas be false or whatever. All right? He wasn't addressing that. And, you know, and Thomas and Nathaniel are trying to get him to address that. He said, no. Okay. But the very first paragraph of this book says, okay, we're assuming that you've done what Jesus told you to do. And you have the ideal of God. Okay, but the first paragraph says, now it's time to think about your ideas. Your ideas are garbage, it says in the first paragraph. Every idea you have is false. And we need to start from scratch. And to get you a true idea of God, you can't just talk about God. You got to talk about ultimatons and the Archaeozoic, and the Melchizedek missionaries in the Orient, and then and everything else you can think of. Because to get that full philosophic picture, you have to get a full picture. Now, you are correct.
It's a holographic picture of the total reality of this local, of this entire creation.
Right.
And you know, it's the history of a local planet. I don't know how you get all that out of it.
Okay, just see, what it is initially when someone's reading it, you can't get to the truth. Remember, you can't read truth. It says right in the book, truth can't be defined with words. So, you know, what you're just doing initially when you're reading it, which can be of great help, apart from truth, right, is just getting a less parochial picture of the universe and of your relationship to God. You know, that you live in a vast universe of inhabited worlds. You're not the only inhabited world. And God loves you absolutely. There's no preconditions on that. And Jesus didn't have to die for your sins. And I mean, they go through, and the basic things that you can get reading through it can completely transform your life. And has transformed a number of people's lives. All I'm saying is, I'm not saying that that isn't extremely important. It's a fantastic psychological procedure to get you unstuck and help you proceed. If you're wallowing in the primitive notions around you, it can liberate you from that and get you moving. But no one should forget that's just step one. That's the coordination of essential knowledge step. It's super transformative and important. I'll just say it again. I'm not saying it isn't. Okay? But don't anyone forget that there's a very remote, intangible thing that you can strive for, which can't be achieved by just reading it, you know, and having a better cosmology and a better story of Jesus' life, you know, and et cetera. A knowledge of the hierarchy of angels and what have you, okay? And that's the truth, the revelation of truth. And you have to know that truth is not something easy to acquire, since humans have never been able to figure out what the word means, right? A good dictionary, we'll quote Pontius Pilate, quid est veritas, what is truth, okay? So when I'm saying these things, don't think that I'm somehow trying to take away what you've found with the book. All I'm saying is don't make sure you don't put a ceiling on your relationship to the book. Know that there's an infinite depth that can be plumbed, and what I was saying earlier, which I'm sure was quite inscrutable, right? I'm just trying to hint at what those depths involve. They involve a very sophisticated challenge to your mind, right? You need to think better than Aristotle ever did. You certainly need to think better than Kant, you know, or Hegel did, right? And they were 5,000 times smarter than me, okay? But you got to think better than them, you know, in order to really appreciate some of the things that are in this book. There's a lot more to this book, right, than meets the eye. That's all I'm reminding everyone of. And because there's a lot more, we all have to keep in mind that there's some things that are said in here that you should not be saying to a timid soul. Right? When you know that what someone needs is just a reminder that God loves them. Okay, don't give them a book that has a paragraph that tells them that their prayer is an abomination. That's not what they should be hearing. Jesus never told anyone that. Right? Because that would be inappropriate to his mission. But this book says that, you know, or it says, so you, particular flavor of religionists, you know, your religious ideas are grotesque. Jesus never told, you know, in his ministry around the Mediterranean, when he came up to the person from the Far East, did he look, you know, deeply in their eyes and say, you know, your religious ideas are grotesque? Is that how Jesus approached that person? No, of course he didn't. Right? But this book does.
In a context,
see, that requires, whoa, how do you put that in a context so that isn't just crude and grotesque itself? How does saying that something is grotesque not grotesque itself? How can that, I mean, that's why the book is so vast and so deep and so complicated. And is not something, you know, that you should be handing to just anyone.
With the life and teachings of Jesus, the purpose of giving us those teachings, because it says in the Urantia book, being in the presence of Jesus, not so much what he taught was...
Exactly.
Was, you get it by osmosis, almost.
Right, it's the faith of Jesus. Yeah.
And the other thing I want to say is, the Urantia book is like the difference between the geocentric theory and the heliocentric theory. And mm-hmm. It makes that much difference.
Yeah, the cosmology is that radically transformative. I agree.
If the main thing the book can do is get an individual to realize that God is much bigger and much more complex and much more extensive and much more infinite, whatever much more infinite means, but by understanding that you don't understand what God is because we can't contemplate it, that's where the grotesque comes in. When we use symbols to represent God, they're a grotesque comparison because God's infinitely good, infinitely beyond our understanding good.
Yeah.
But that's where Jesus, when you can see yourself in his presence all the time, and you operate as if he is there in truth, you're doing something very akin to turning to the Father and atoning with the Father, and you get that feeling
Let's get it back to this section. We're talking about Melchizedek. We can't go off on these tangents indefinitely here.
Thank you for
Just, but
I
yes.
could feel what she could feel in that and why she was going there.
Just remember, it's just like Katie says, right? You know, keep that in mind that if you're gonna engage someone with this book, you need to do it very personally, very intimately, because there are some things that are going to be very difficult for them to handle, right? And so don't just plop it in their hands. Develop a personal relationship with them and help them to find that awakening picture that you were just speaking to. Okay. All right, so back to Abraham. So we've kind of wrapped up what Abraham is up to. He's got Isaac married off, you know, and so his descendants are launching forth. But just, you know, like I was pointing out at the end there, before Abraham died, he was definitely establishing some more influences. You know, with the weight of his, you know, of who he was, that were not enlightened from Melchizedek. You know, he was taking some of the established mores, and by adopting them as Abraham, you know, he was giving them credence and weight they didn't have in the hands of Abimelech. Okay? And so that's what they're reminding you between the lines, that a lot of that, you know, baggage that the Old Testament is laboring through got set up because of Abraham so quickly letting, you know, not being able to hold on to Melchizedek's more enlightened approach. Okay? All right, let's keep going.
It was hard for the next generation to comprehend the story of Melchizedek. Within 500 years, many regarded the whole narrative as a myth. Isaac held fairly well to the teachings of his father and nourished the gospel of the Salem colony. But it was harder for Jacob to grasp the significance of these traditions. Joseph was a firm believer in Melchizedek and was, largely because of this, regarded by his brothers as a dreamer. Joseph's honor in Egypt was chiefly due to the memory of his great-grandfather Abraham. Joseph was offered military command of the Egyptian armies, but being such a firm believer in the traditions of Melchizedek and the later teachings of Abraham and Isaac, he elected to serve as a civil administrator, believing that he could thus better labor for the advancement of the kingdom of heaven.
Okay, so I was hinting at this, you know, way back earlier tonight, that you know, not only do you have that statement that within 500 years, many regarded the whole narrative about Melchizedek as a myth. See, and it's not just because it wasn't written down, you know, and was being passed forward by oral tradition. You know, it's more than that. There isn't a tendency for them to try to remember historical facts and preserve them inviolate, you know, from one generation to the next. That's just not their modus operandi, okay? All of that is, you know, the concept of fact was given to us during the Enlightenment, okay? The three centuries prior to the 20th century. Before that, facts was just not really an issue on the planet. In very short order, they're not thinking of him, you know, as being this literal person that was there. So it's not surprising, and you know they're going to mention that here shortly, that when you get to them rewriting the Jewish histories, you know, into the Old Testament during the exile, I mean, they're not really going to be thinking of Melchizedek as a historical character, you know, and so they're not going to think, well, we can't just change, you know, the conversation between Abraham and Melchizedek to be between Abraham and God, between Abraham and Yahweh. You know, it's like, no, of course they can, because Melchizedek is just a myth, and they can tell that the myth is what they're talking about is God. You know, so they're not thinking that they're corrupting it by changing it to Yahweh from Melchizedek. They're trying to take it out of the myth and say it directly. That's what they were thinking. That's just the way things are. Like I said, it didn't even take anywhere near that long, and no one really believed that Jesus was a corporeal being. And then with Abraham's descendants directly, like I said, I mean, Isaac is, you know, holding on to it reasonably well because he was kind of more directly connected. But you get to Jacob, and it's getting really fuzzy. You know, and with the exception of Joseph, right, all the children of Jacob, you know, it's basically just totally fuzzed out. So it doesn't take long at all, right? And you're going to have a people that are going to need lots of Melchizedek-tweaked individuals, prophets, right, to come to them over and over and over again and try to remind them of the one God and to not just get sucked into all the human sacrifice and what have you of all the people around you. Right? So that's why the story in the Old Testament is just endless cycle of going around and around and around like it does, you know. They get reminded, they forget. They get reminded, they forget. They get reminded, they forget. And it just goes over and over and over and over again.
And, yep. I wonder about the people outside Middle East or outside Israel. What about them? Don't they need any God during these times that, you know, they need the messengers to remember?
Yeah.
Remind them,
well, that was, again, that's the point of those Melchizedek missionaries going out, to try to bring this upliftment out there. And, you know, as we'll read when we get into the Melchizedek missionary papers, like I said, they tried to, Melchizedek was trying to kind of give them a quote-unquote sky father sort of an idea. So it's not surprising that if you go to, you know, ancient India or ancient China, right, their most ancient God concepts are the Sky Father, right? Because they got that from the Melchizedek missionaries. Now, you know, and in local context, it got, you know, blurred and lost and changed and whatnot. But if you go back to their most ancient teachings, somewhere in there, there's the Sky Father, because they got that from the Melchizedek missionaries, right? You know, if you're a Greek, you have Zeus, yeah, you know, et cetera. You've got some sky father. That's coming from the Melchizedek missionaries. All right, let's see. Anything else we did there? Oh, just the one little comment. All of Joseph's brothers, who are kind of totally, you know, back into the ghost cult stuff, you know, they were basically thinking, just like everyone thought about Jesus, you know, I think he's kind of beside himself. He's a dreamer, quote unquote. See, anyone who tries to think differently than the status quo in the ghost cult, you know, is at best going to be thought to be a dreamer, if not just beside themselves. Remember that. If you really definitively take a hold of the fifth epical revelation, don't expect to be greeted as, you know, an extremely enlightened being. You're probably going to thought to be crazy. Anyway, let's keep going.
The teaching of Melchizedek was full and replete, but the records of these days seemed impossible and fantastic to the later Hebrew priests, although many had some understanding of these transactions, at least up to the times of the en masse editing of the Old Testament records in Babylon.
Okay, so there's a little comment. I've already referred to that many times. You have all of these records that they've kept, okay, but there's going to be an en masse editing of them during the exile. Yeah, like I said, the teachings were full and replete, but the records of those days seemed impossible and fantastic to the later Hebrew priests. Right? It just no one could you know had the context. Like we were talking earlier, that's one of the important things about the Urantia book, is to give you that big cosmological context. You know, so that you can have
Abraham was the what? Babylonian captivity.
Many. You know, it's in the Babylonian captivity is in the 6th century BC, and this is, you know, Melchizedek came in 1980 BC. So many centuries.
Writings?
You really didn't have a written Hebrew language until the exile, until the 6th century BC. You know, Hebrew written like it is today. Again, there was oral tradition records. There were some written records, you know. Remember, there's cuneiform. You know, you've got some ancient writing there. But anyway, I mean, like I was saying, you know, it just they you know you need that bigger cosmological context of the revelation for you to be able to understand. You know, like how fundamental fundamental particles can behave the way we observe them without magic. See, if you don't have the revelation, when you study electrons and the atomic nucleus and stuff, it behaves in a way that the only way you can rationalize that is with magical assumptions. I mean, you need the Urantia book, that cosmological context, in order to have logical assumptions about the nature of fundamental particles. Space-time continuum is magical. Quantum mechanics is based on magic. That's just in sort of fundamental physics. They're hearing these stories about Melchizedek, and it's like, well, that all sounds just magical. Okay, I mean, we just are talking about, you know, them building a body for him, and then him incarnating into that body, and then him de-incarnating out of that body, and them disassembling the body. Okay, but none of that was magical. And the only reason that we can kind of think that that maybe isn't magical, although it's still kind of difficult, is we do have some science now. It's like, well, okay, I guess if you were just a lot more knowledgeable about this stuff, I guess I could imagine you could build a human body. I mean, we've got some really smart people that are imagining that one day they're going to build an android that's so sophisticated that, you know, it's indistinguishable from me jiggling air molecules right now. Right? But, you know, think about these guys, you know, way back there in the 6th century B.C. that are reading these records, those Hebrew priests. They're going, I just can't make any sense out of this. It all just seems fanciful, right? Yep.
He didn't pretend that he's a demigod to them. Mm-hmm. He pretended that he is like one of us.
Mm-hmm.
So yep. They couldn't have any record of him being built or, That's not something that he...
But remember, you do have the author in Hebrews. They know that he had no father or mother. You know, so the Hebrew priests know that. It's like, okay, so I'm supposed to believe that there was this guy that lived, you know, several centuries ago, and he didn't have a father or mother. Yeah, right. Right. That's the kind of stuff that they're getting at. They're going, it's just a myth, right? All right.
What the Old Testament records describe as conversations between Abraham and God were in reality conferences between Abraham and Melchizedek. Later scribes regarded the term Melchizedek as synonymous with God. The record of so many contacts of Abraham and Sarah with the angel of the Lord refers to their numerous visits with Melchizedek.
We already kind of talked about, that they thought he was a myth, and so they say, technically we're talking about God here, not about some guy named Melchizedek, so let's just call him God. Then they're pointing out, it's kind of fun, at times in the Urantia book, in the Bible, excuse me, in the Old Testament, when it says, quote unquote, the angel of the Lord, the is important. Notice the is in the quotes. Not an angel of the Lord, New Testament stuff, but the angel of the Lord in the Old Testament. Remember how they tell you that, it has most basically has nothing to do with angels, seraphim. In general, that's a reference to a brilliant evening star. When there's historical validity to the reference, it's referring to a brilliant evening star. Here they're pointing out, they kind of see in that same mode, they refer to Melchizedek as the angel of the Lord. But the tricky thing is to not think so scientifically about that, like we can't help but do. I mean, it's the same, it seems like, well, they're talking about the angel of the Lord, not the Lord, but that's not the way they really processed it. It was really just another name for God.
Well, in a way it was,
okay.
Because right? Anything that they ever saw of him, he's the perfect, probably the perfect expression of Father Melchizedek. They were on exactly the same track. And Father Melchizedek's just a face of the Father, so...
Right. You understand it. But the point is, They're saying, now coincidentally, even though the, when they wrote the angel of the Lord, they were really kind of just talking about Yahweh. But see, you can go, well, actually, you know, instead of replacing Melchizedek by Yahweh, if you replaced Melchizedek by the angel of the Lord, okay, there's kind of a truth to that, like you were just saying. Okay, it's this emissary, just like a brilliant evening star is this emissary, quote unquote, from God. So that's why they're mentioning it there. It's just kind of a funny little aside. It's like, well, actually, you know, that works better if they replaced it by the angel of the Lord. Yep.
In the Old Testament, you know, the first five books up until Moses, you know, they didn't really have angels. They had mostly like one God only. Later on, like in Daniel and those books,
right,
that we see all these angels.
Right. Yeah, and not only. You know, having angels and all that sort of stuff is a later, you know, development. But you know, even dual spiritism is not there in the beginnings of some of those stories. You know, you have just one being, and he does both the good things and the bad things. You have one being who both is the author of good luck and bad luck. You know, it was later on that you had in dual spiritism that you have some being that's the author of good luck and another being that's the author of bad luck, right? You know, and so Bible scholars, you know, struggle with that. It's like, well, I don't know, that doesn't. God seems to be actually doing the bad stuff and the good stuff, you know, and it's because those stories are so ancient that they're really pre-dual spiritism, you know. Which is difficult for Christians because Christianity is so influenced by Zoroastrianism with its very strong dual spiritism, right? The dark and the light. You know, so Christians are just ensconced in the dual spiritism, you know, and everything they think.
If you say, what do you mean by dual spiritism?
It's just that there's good and bad.
Like yin and yang?
Yeah, I mean, yin and yang is kind of similar, you know, it's not as stark. You know, as dark and light, but you know the idea of you know that there's a duality. You know, you have how many you know fuzzy human stories, movies you watch where there has to be a balance in the universe. You know, they're always talking about things like that. I mean, that's all that dual spiritism sort of rationalization, even if it isn't stark on black white. You know, if it's a little more yin yang, say or something, it's still. It's that duality, you know, and that's another thing that the Rancho's book is trying to do. It's like, okay, there is no dual spiritism, there isn't white ooze out there and black ooze out there, and try not to let the black ooze get in your ears. There is no black ooze, right? The universe is innately good, right? There is no, you know, equal badness afoot out there. And that's very difficult for someone who's grown up in dual spiritism. Okay.
The Hebrew narratives of Isaac, Jacob, and Joseph are far more reliable than those about Abraham, although they also contain many diversions from the facts, alterations made intentionally and unintentionally at the time of the compilation of these records by the Hebrew priests during the Babylonian captivity. Keturah was not a wife of Abraham. Like Hagar, she was merely a concubine. All of Abraham's property went to Isaac, the son of Sarah, the status wife. Abraham was not so old as the records indicate, and his wife was much younger. These ages were deliberately altered in order to provide for the subsequent alleged miraculous birth of Isaac.
Yeah, you had to have that whole miraculous birth of Isaac thing. And they just, you know, notice like they're saying, it's like I mentioned, it's the, a lot of Abraham stuff is, you know, not even close to factual. But when it's sort of less important, when you get to the subsequent people, you know, there was less changing, right? The more important the priests and scribes felt the story was, the more they had a tendency to consciously change it, right? Yeah, so that's just, you know, very reasonable. You can understand how it works that way. You know, and of course, you were looking for Hagar. There's Hagar.
But Sarah, had only one son, it seems like.
It's important, you know, like with Keturah, you know, you have all kinds of kids. I mean, you know, they're... You have to remind yourself of the whole, you know, even if you have multiple wives, or if you have a wife and multiple concubines, or what, you know, whatever the marriage mores were of the time, you know, there was the status wife, right? And you know, you can have all kinds of stories with all sorts of machinations about who's going to, who Abraham's going to pass it on to and all that. Okay, but there really isn't any questions like that, right? It's passed on to the status wife's child. That's the whole point of the status wife, you know, in those multiple schemes. So they're just reminding you of that. And, you know, remember the other big thing that they're trying to do when they're telling these stories is they want everyone's children to explain all the peoples of the region. Right, so there's this whole effort of, Lot, has children with his two daughters, you know, and so then you can explain these people and these people, you know, they're the descendants from this daughter and that daughter. There was always that tendency to try to rationalize all the people around you. The historical validity of all those rationalization schemes, I mean, who knows, you know, how much that's valid. But, of course, people who take those stories in the Old Testament very literally pin everything on, you know, they know, you know, where so-and-so peoples come from. You know, they're the children of that guy, you know. But, they're just reminding you to, you got to be cautious about all that stuff.
They tweak our sense of equality here. Like Hagar, she was merely
the Ooh. Yeah, and of course...
One wife, and the rest were concubines.
And of course, the merely part, you know, them's fighting words. You know, that'll get you killed, you know, in some parts of the planet. Right, I mean, the book doesn't beat around the bush, you know. Because all that... The lineage thing, you know, that we think all these, you know, Ishmael sets up this whole lineage and people put their whole sense of identity on that lineage. And, you know, it's because all that was rationalized back then. You know, is there any validity to any of that stuff? Mostly no. Everyone was just intermarrying everywhere. It was just a hodgepodge. Okay.
The national ego of the Jews was tremendously depressed by the Babylon captivity. In their reaction against national inferiority, they swung to the other extreme of national and racial egotism, in which they distorted and perverted their traditions with the view of exalting themselves above all races as the chosen people of God. And hence, they carefully edited all their records for the purpose of raising Abraham and their other national leaders high up above all other persons, not excepting Melchizedek himself. The Hebrew scribes therefore destroyed every record of these momentous times which they could find, preserving only the narrative of the meeting of Abraham and Melchizedek after the Battle of Sidon, which they deemed reflected great honor upon Abraham.
Just reminding you why they kept that one little snippet there in Genesis about Melchizedek. You know, and, you know, all the political, you know, incorrectness of talking about the chosen people thing. And, you know, being very direct about swinging to the other extreme of national and racial egotism, you know, and it's that unfortunate, you know, the degree to which that national and racial egotism is very definitively held on to, right, up to this day, that still annoys a lot of people severely, right? You know, I mean, we have animal instincts. You know, when someone is extremely egotistical about being the chosen people, you know, your animal instinct, especially in a male, right, wants to rub that smug expression off your face. It's a very difficult thing to civilize and control, right? And so, yeah, it's not just the whole Christian thing of the Jews killed Jesus and so we should hate the Jews, okay? It's not just that. The chosen people thing has caused endless problems throughout the centuries, including in the 20th century and since still today. It's a very unfortunate tendency, and we just, you can say, well, you shouldn't respond, poorly to that. It's like, well, yeah, I shouldn't have certain chemistry. I mean, I have certain chemical reactions in my body that are just what they are. I can't turn them off, right? We're animal origin creatures. And so, just reminding you of that, it was a big problem way back then. Got them into all kinds of problems with the Romans. It's still getting them into problems today. Yeah. But those scribes and priests back during the captivity, like they're saying, okay, they told the story where, it's not a question about whether or not they are the chosen people. They are. God says so. So, the fact that it's a sacred text means this is a very, you can't expect the Jews to ever let go of that. The only way that'll disappear is when we let go of all of our religions like Judaism and Christianity and Buddhism and, until we let go of those things. Yeah, but again, they won't, right, yeah. Because again, it's just, the heart gets hardened and you want to hold on to the thing that really gives you a sense of worth. And that's what gives a lot of them a sense of worth. So they're not going to let go of it. You're not going to change them.
If they would revere him, they could still take the lead the way they were intended to.
Yeah, of course. But, all right.
And thus, in losing sight of Melchizedek, they also lost sight of the teaching of this emergency son regarding the spiritual mission of the promised bestowal son. Lost sight of the nature of this mission so fully and completely that very few of their progeny were able or willing to recognize and receive Michael when he appeared on earth and in the flesh as Machaventa had foretold.
So just like you were pointing out, that's one of the reasons why they couldn't make that transition and recognize Jesus for who he really was, is because they had so willfully pushed away the Melchizedek heritage that they just didn't have the context to recognize Jesus. The only thing they could come up with is Jesus was beside himself. It's like I was saying before, see? They just didn't have that context. They didn't have the context for Melchizedek, so they basically rejected him. And like they're pointing out, well, that means you're going to end up rejecting Jesus too, because Melchizedek was setting the context for you to be able to accept him for what he said he was.
They were expecting a second David.
Yeah, right. Instead, they're looking for a second David. One of those heroes that they aggrandized, like they just said. Yeah, so, and with the chosen people, you have that whole Messiah thing that they built up around that, too. Hold on 1 second, just, yep.
Jesus never said that the Jews are the chosen people. He never said that.
No.
But you said God has chosen them.
Well, I was just pointing out that, like they're saying here, okay, most of that chosen people stuff, is their fabrication, like they just said. But it doesn't change the fact that Machaventa started things up with Abraham, and the Melchizedek receivers continue to foster that lineage with prophets. Right. So even though they aren't the chosen people, they, in their sense of it, they were a people who were being engaged much more actively than other peoples. Okay? Because, you know, they knew that Jesus would be coming there, not to China. And so, okay, or North America. And so they, you know, they can't, you know, they have only so many hands. And so they were trying to keep that little nest, you know, fertile enough, you know, until Jesus arrived. And so they end up being kind of indirectly chosen, if you will, you know, because of that. But, you know, and even Jesus, you know, reminded them that the Most High Observer has been sheltering you people. But the Most High Observer is going to take away his hand of shelter, which is kind of a quasi-chosen, see, you know, validity of that chosen people thing. He says, you know, but soon he's going to take away the, you know, his sheltering hand, and you guys are not going to fare well. You know, and of course, almost immediately, the Romans just decimated them and either killed them or sent them into slavery to the four corners of the earth, salted all their fields. And right. Soon as the Melchizedek, or the Most High Observer, I mean, you know, took back his sheltering hand, it went very poorly for them really quickly, just like Jesus said it would.
But one of the writers of the book of Hebrews understood the mission of Melchizedek, for it is written, "This Melchizedek, priest of the Most High, was also king of peace, without father, without mother, without pedigree, having neither beginning of days nor end of life, but made like a son of God, he abides a priest continually." This writer designated Melchizedek as a type of the later bestowal of Michael, affirming that Jesus was a minister forever on the order of Melchizedek. While this comparison was not altogether fortunate, it was literally true that Christ did receive provisional title to Urantia upon the orders of the 12 Melchizedek receivers on duty at the time of his world bestowal.
Remember, we talked about that right up front in this paper, right? It was, you know, when Jesus, you know, engaged the planetary prince there on Mount Hermon, that's when the planetary prince lost his title, and that title went to Jesus. You know, Jesus, Michael is now titular planetary prince of Urantia. And they're just reminding you of a little bit behind the scenes. It was that at that point that the Melchizedek receivers left, right? So once that title was shifted, and see, upon the orders of the 12 Melchizedek receivers. You know, this is the only spot that they give you that little detail. Yeah, and again, you know, like we already talked about the bit in Hebrews, you know, all this stuff that the Hebrew priest during the exile didn't know what to make of. And it's just, okay, what the heck are we going to do with, you know, without father, without mother, without pedigree, you know, et cetera. And it's so non sequitur, right, that when Martin Luther produced his German translation of the New Testament, the book of Hebrews and all the other books at the end of the New Testament, he put at the end of the New Testament because he thought, oh man, each one of these books has got something, you know, that's going to be difficult for the common folk to deal with. Right? When it's all in Latin, they can't get confused. But you can actually give it to him in German. And he thought about just dropping all those books from Hebrews on because of the confusing things in them for the common folk. But finally, he decided tradition just wouldn't let him do it. But he said, "Well, I got to at least put them at the end." So that's why they're at the end. And they say, you know, this, while this comparison was not altogether fortunate, see, it's those things that are not altogether fortunate that basically Luther was, you know, recognizing. It's like, well, okay, that's kind of problematic. Yeah, they're telling you there's some validity to that. That's not just bias by, say, Luther or someone. If you get too literal about the priest after the order of Melchizedek, you know, you get off on a false tangent. Yep.
Is the book of Hebrews the same as the Paul's epistle?
Yeah, I mean, it's called Paul's Epistle to the Hebrews.
Yes.
But they're reminding you, it has more authors than just Paul. Yeah, and the scholars recognize the kind of polyglot nature of the book of Hebrews. So here, one of the writers of the book of Hebrews are reminding you of that here. Just think about someone who's very strongly in the Jewish tradition. He's not going to be bringing in this extra Hebrew scriptures stuff about Melchizedek. That's going to be someone else. All right. Well, we went way, way, way over here, so let's wrap it up here. We'll finish out this paper and move on to the Melchizedek missionaries next time. Thanks, everyone. Let's take a moment here.